It's on and off. Test, test. Is it on? Have I failed to plug it in? Test, test. Test, test. Okay. All right, well, we'll just... still handing out sheets. Sorry, I did print some out. It's still the same material from last week. Hopefully we'll get through all of this lesson in Old Testament this week. We move into New Testament next week. So, before I just jump right in, I want to see if anybody recalled David's sermon last week. He was talking about resolving disputes, and we're going through 1 Corinthians. And specifically, he was talking about, you know, Christians should seek to resolve their disputes between each other and not go into a court of law and be subject to the judgment of unbelievers, right? And then he was reading, of course, from Paul, and he got to the portion where Paul talks about judging the angels. You guys remember that? Is that ringing a bell?
Yeah. Thank you for reminding
me. So I want to start here. First of all, the things I'm about to say are not critical at all. I have a very deep respect for David as both a person and a teacher. I think the work he does is tremendous. He is certainly much smarter than the average evangelical preacher, at least in my experience. His depth of scripture is profound, and I can tell he's someone that continues to study. So is that effusive enough? I'm not trying to be critical. The point I want to make here is I like the way that he handled it, because there are certainly alternatives that I think would have been less favorable and probably more common. In particular, he said, I'm not really sure what Paul's talking about here. He just called it as he saw it, rather than trying to get into some complicated explanation about what Paul possibly meant about us judging angels, because that's a big one. That's about as complicated as something can be, I think. And admittedly, one of the goals here is to try to disambiguate a little bit of that. I'm not going to tell you that I've got 100% answered exactly what was on Paul's mind. We'll talk about that as we get in the New Testament. But I guess what I wanted to say is that it's really even difficult to read Paul's epistles or even talk about Pauline theology without running right into this stuff. He just talked about the spiritual powers so much. He really had a very advanced and in-depth theology of the spiritual realm. So I just wanted to visit that for a minute, because I like the way he handled it. I like the way that he acknowledged it. He acknowledged that it was something beyond what the rest of the context of what Paul had just been talking about and continues to talk about. But he didn't flatten it. He didn't try to call it something that it wasn't. He didn't try to simplify it. He also didn't ignore it. So kudos to David. All right, so we're going to pick up. Hey, there's the microphone. We're going to pick up where we left off in the Old Testament narrative. We were talking about the cherubim, the mercy seat, and their connection and fulfillment to Jesus. So in particular, I'll just start over here. The Ark of the Covenant, of course, is made of wood. It's gold-plated. And then the lid, the top, the cover, is solid gold. It's a solid gold construction that then has gold cherubim on top of it. When we read about this in Old Testament, the Hebrew word for specifically the top of the Ark of the Covenant, the word is kaporet, and that gets translated as mercy seat. What it means in Hebrew is it just means atonement. Some translations try to say atonement cover to the end, tie it back to this physical object. Why would we just use this word atonement when we're talking about a thing? But that's what the Bible does. And in Greek, they translate this word kaparetas, hilasterion. And it gets used over and over and over in the Old Testament. I'm going to read from Exodus chapter 25. It's going to be on the screen if you'd like to examine it yourself in your Bible. Exodus 25, we're going to read verses 17 through 22. You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. 2 cubits and a half shall be its length, and 1.5 cubits its breadth. And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold. Of hammered work shall you make them. On the 2 ends of the mercy seat, make 1 cherub on one end and 1 cherub on the other end. Of 1 piece with the mercy seat shall you make the cherubim on its 2 ends. The cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings. Their faces, one to another, towards the mercy seat shall the faces of the cherubim be. And you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark. And in the ark shall you put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, from between the 2 cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. So a lot of information packed in there about what's going on here. And I really want to highlight that God tells them his intention after you build this is to meet them above this cover, above this atonement cover, the mercy seat. He will appear above them and apparently descend between where these cherub are spreading their wings on the place where he will alight. So the imagery here is God appears, and if this is the mercy seat, then we can imagine, if he's in a seated posture, we can imagine that his feet would be on the cover, on this atoning cover. This mercy seat is where we find God. Tells us right there. And this is the image. This is the image that the Israelites had when they envisioned God appearing on the Day of Atonement, because that's when all of this would occur. That's why we have the word atonement linked with this object, because of course it's where the high priest would come in and apply the blood. But the translation, in particular, the strange English words are trying to combine this idea of this object plus what the Israelites meant to them, what it meant theologically, what it meant to them as a representation of God, all in one. And so we get mercy seat. And so God meets them from above this mercy seat, and it functions as the place of atonement. And the root word of kaparet, of course, we find another word, kippur, yom kippur, day of atonement. It's all linked together. And we read in Leviticus 16, 14 and 15. This is the process. And he shall take some of the blood of the bull and sprinkle it with his finger on the front of the mercy seat on the east side. And in front of the mercy seat, he shall sprinkle some of the blood with his finger 7 times. Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering that is for the people and bring its blood inside the veil and do with its blood as he did with the blood of the bull, sprinkling it over the mercy seat in front of the mercy seat. Mercy seat, mercy seat. It just says it over and over again. This process that's unfolding here of bringing in the blood of the atoning sacrifice and sprinkling it and getting forgiveness from God, this whole process is biblically known as propitiation. This is how in the Old Testament the Israelites maintain the sacred space for God to continue dwelling with them and receiving forgiveness for their unintentional sins. This propitiation is not just satisfying God. It's not just, okay, I'm not going to be so mad at you for that. This is satisfying God's righteous wrath in a very personal manner. He is wrathful towards you, and therefore you must do something to atone for it. Since you don't really have the ability to do that yourself, it's all facilitated through the sacrificial system. And so the expiation of sins occurs through the process of propitiation is essentially what's happening here. The Old Testament doesn't use the word, English word, propitiation, but it certainly depicts this at the mercy seat on the Day of Atonement. Propitiation is effectively what the mercy seat does. It's not something that just gets added in later. This is where it has its roots. So when we hear talking about it with Jesus, we know that it originated in the Old Testament. Here's where we can find it. So this mercy seat is where holiness and justice and mercy all intersects through atoning blood. So the Ark of the Covenant also has another designation, and that is the footstool of God. And this gets repeated quite a bit. I've got three examples here. I'll read them for you quickly. In 1 Chronicles 28:2, then King David arose to his feet and said, "Hear me, my brothers and my people. I had it in my heart to build a house for the rest of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God. And I made preparations for the building." So David refers to this as the footstool. This is one of the early references. It's not really clear just by what he's saying, what he's talking about, or why he would call it that. But let's keep going. Psalm 99:5. "Exalt the Lord our God. Worship at his footstool. Holy is he." Same language here. This isn't another object. We're referring to the Ark of the Covenant. Psalm 132, 7 and 8. "Let us go to his dwelling place. Let us worship at his footstool. Arise, O Lord, and go to your resting place, you and the ark of your might." So there we have more explicit connection, the parallelism, the footstool, the ark of your might. We're talking about the same thing. And again, the idea is God is enthroned above the cherubim, above the mercy seat. And the footstool, again, is where his feet are going to be resting on this pure solid gold cover, the atoning cover, where we sprinkle, the Israelite priest would sprinkle the blood at God's feet. So the enthronement of God is ultimately how the Israelites would see this. They had an anthropomorphic view of how God would appear. Of course, it's the same representation that we see repeated in Scripture a lot. The supernatural vision with the flaming skin and the radiant glory of the sun. In all of these descriptions, God seems to have a humanoid appearance, so that's what they were thinking here. Now, we get even more clarity about kind of this connection to footstool. It becomes even more clear as we move into the Solomon's temple period. So when the temple actually gets built, it really magnifies this entire concept. I'm going to read from 1 Kings chapter 6. We're going to read 5 verses, 23 through 28. "In the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high." So this is, again, within the Holy of Holies in the temple. We're no longer in the tabernacle. "Each 10 cubits high, 5 cubits was the length of one wing of the cherub, and 5 cubits the length of the other wing of the other cherub. It was 10 cubits from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other. The other cherub also measured 10 cubits. Both cherubim had the same measure and the same form. The height of one cherubim was 10 cubits, and so was that of the other cherubim. He put the cherubim in the innermost part of the house, and the wings of the cherubim were spread out so that a wing of one touched the one wall, and the wing of the other cherub touched the other wall. The other wings touched each other in the middle of the house, and he overlaid the cherubim with gold." So in this imagery, we are getting a clear depiction of the temple that Solomon built, and we have these 15-foot tall cherubims in the inner sanctum. And they have their wings spread out so that they're filling the room, but the two in the middle intersect as one piece. They come down, and they're over the Ark of the Covenant. Again, 1 Chronicles 28:18, "For the altar of incense made of refined gold and its weight, also is planned for the golden chariot of the cherubim that spread their wings and covered the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord." So the idea here is, again, magnifying this whole imagery of God being enthroned. We have two cherubim, massive 15-foot tall, and their adjoined wings. The Bible also says that these are one piece. Fashion them as one piece. And the idea now is God will be enthroned upon those wings, and his feet are now resting on the Ark of the Covenant. This is the imagery that they have of the cherubim throne that they build within the Ark of the Solomon Temple. Goodness, said a mouthful there. The chariot imagery is dependent on these ideas of the winged servant, these mystical beings, these spiritual beings that can just travel in all directions and protect the throne as it moves about. Chariot is used right there, golden chariot, Merkaba. That's the Hebrew word for it. The Old Testament often depicts him as enthroned on the chariot. It gets repeated over and over again. Here's a lot of examples of it. 1 Samuel 4:4. So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. 2 Samuel 6:2. And David arose and went with all the people who were there with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned on the cherubim. 2 Kings 9:15, also Isaiah 37:16. O Lord of hosts, God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone. Of all the kingdoms of earth, you have made the heaven and earth. And then there's two additional ones, Psalm 81 and 99:1. So all of this imagery comes together to build the mercy seat. Is not just the top of the ark. It's the theological enthronement of God. It's where he would dwell on earth, where he was enthroned, and he would appear once a year on the Day of Atonement in these places for the high priest to perform the atoning ritual that we just saw there, propitiation. So let's put all this together. We have the throne, we have the space above the cherubim overshadowing the mercy seat, and we have the footstool, it's the ark beneath, the resting place for the divine authority. And then we have the place of atonement, which is where the blood resolves the tension between God's holiness and Israel's sin. So bring this all together in Jesus, how do we get there? Well, this word hilasterion that we see in the Septuagint, it does make an appearance in the New Testament. We're going to read from Romans 3. Verses 24 through 25. And are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood, to be received by faith. This was to show God's righteousness, because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. So here, this word propitiation that we see in English, this is the Greek word hilasterion. Jesus is being presented here as the hilasterion. He is the final propitiation. He is the ultimate atonement. So through his blood, God deals with all of this for once and for all, so we don't have to continue making empty sacrifices. We don't need a geographical location. We don't need a solid gold box. We don't need a person to do the work for us. And in the end, these aren't new concepts. When Paul's writing about propitiation, he understands very well where he got that origin, where spiritually this is linked all back to the work Christ has done. Hebrews 9:11-12. But when Christ appeared as a high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is, not of his creation, he entered once and for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by the means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. Jesus enters the true holy place, that's the temple of our body, and it's not with an animal blood, but his own. Whatever was pictured in this mercy seat, whatever the idea was there, Jesus is again the fulfillment of it. And the cherubim throne is a symbol of his final authority and his resting place on earth within us. All right, well, that concludes that portion of the lesson. Any questions before I move on to the next part? Okay. So now we're going to move into the patriarchal period. We're going to talk about Abraham, Hagar, and Jacob. So, of course, when we talk about Abraham's encounters, there are a couple that in particular that really stick out here. We want to talk about the announcement of the birth of Isaac, and we also want to talk about judgment upon Sodom. So we're going to start in Genesis 18, verses 8 through 10. If I can get there, that'd be great. There we go. Then he took curds and milk and the calf he had prepared, and he set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate. They said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "She's in the tent." The Lord said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Okay. So just that brief interlude, we get a lot of information about the manifest presence of these spiritual beings. So to begin with, when these beings walk up, they're described as three men. We're not given any indicator that they have supernatural properties. They're not flaming or shining. They don't have wings. It just says three men. And then they walk up and they see, they're not just a kind of a shifting vision or something translucent or intangible. They can be located in physical space, and they do things. The men eat and drink with Abraham. It tells us that they're standing under a tree, and Abraham's standing by them, and then Sarah, she's in the tent. She knows like physically where these people are. So we're not having some kind of weird vision or seeing things that we don't recognize. These are being perceived as people, and Abraham thinks that he needs to feed them. I think that's also very telling, because if this is God appearing, as the language seems to suggest, he's interested in having a meal. Again, that's a very important characteristic of the Lord and how much he values this type of fellowship. Eating together is a big deal. It's not just something you're doing to refresh yourself. It's not just something, well, hungry again, better eat. The people you choose to eat with, what you eat with them, and if you provided it yourself, very important to God, it seems. And I also find the common theme here that he eats a meal and then immediately reminds them, hey, remember that covenant, remember that promise I made to you? In a year, that's when it's going to happen. That's when I will fulfill that promise. So again, a meal, and we have another covenantal reminder right there with the meal. I can't help but point that pattern out. It's not a coincidence by any means at all. The association of eating with God and then having it really mean something is a recurring theme in the Old and New Testament. So we also notice that these men are speaking in unison to begin with, but then only the Lord talks. Then the Lord said, "I will surely return." This is a strange occurrence that isn't isolated to just this particular episode. We see that a lot, where the who is speaking. When the angels, the spiritual beings, begin to talk to the humans, it shifts between the angel speaking and God speaking. And it just seems to interchange fluidly, like we would understand how and why that's occurring. In verse 22, we're told, "So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord." So somehow, after spending time, or maybe it was immediately, it was clear to Abraham which one was the Lord. And then the two men just depart from the city of Sodom. So they don't vanish in the cloud. They don't go back up to where they came. They don't disappear. They continue walking down a path, and they can be observed going towards the city of Sodom. And of course, in Genesis 19:1, we're told that the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth. So again, it's curious that these men are just walking along, yet somehow Lot knows there's something different about them. He knows that they deserve something more than just a hearty handshake or, hey, hello. He bows himself with his face to the ground when he encounters these beings. Not an act of worship, but it's an act of deep reverence. We're not told how or why it is that he knows to do this, but they're described as angels. This word here is malakim, so that's important because we're being told explicitly that these beings are here to deliver a message. They're acting as God's messengers, and they're appearing as men. In Genesis 19:16, the angels physically deliver Lot's family due to the Lord's mercy, we're told. It's not because the angels decided. It says that as the chaos unfolds and the angels want them out of there and they hesitate and they're scared, the angels grab them physically and move them because the Lord had mercy, not for any other reason. His presence persisted with the angels, even though he apparently is still located back, having this back and forth with Abraham about whether or not he's going to destroy the city of Sodom if there's a righteous person found there. Because that's what they're doing while the two men walk off. So the angels are here to relay a defined decision, but it doesn't originate with them at all. Then in 1924, verses 1924, of course, when the destruction finally comes, we read an interesting phrasing here. It says, "Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven." So it's the angels who are present there. But we're told that the Lord is the one who is acting in Sodom and Gomorrah. And the judgment, the fire, is also coming from the Lord who is in heaven. So we have a duality of action here in which God's presence is still clearly at work and with the angels, with whomever he sent to announce this destruction and be his agent, be his herald. But he is also acting from his throne. This, again, we have some duality here. And this phrasing where we see the Lord doing something and also the Lord doing something else. The Israelites would go on to build this into a theology called two powers in heaven. Jewish theology didn't support this notion of Trinity. It just wasn't part of their belief system. We can read the Old Testament and see evidence of that, but the Jews didn't have that in their mind. What they did have was this idea that gets further depicted in books, especially like Daniel, where we see God clearly enthroned. That's God. But there's someone else there too who receives and has all of God's authority. Who is that? Well, it's the second power. That's the two powers in heaven. And they understood that there is a messianic connection here, but really understanding and resolving what does this mean to me as a worshiper and believer when my God is one, that was a really hairy topic. And in fact, as Jesus came to be and lived and died and resurrected, certain sects of Jews really didn't want to continue teaching this two powers in heaven idea because their fear was it would give credence to this guy who said he was Jesus. Because that's who he was claiming to be, right? And that's who everyone thought he was. So it was a real problem. But that's what we're seeing here very early on, Genesis 19. It's already being represented as God working in multiple persons. So judgment here is being portrayed as morally grounded. It's not arbitrary. Of course, we know Abraham has a long conversation with God just so he can feel better about it. And the Old Testament and New Testament really expound upon the wickedness of these cities. Genesis 22:11-12. "But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, 'Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me.'" So here we are again with Abraham. And he's... Of course, he's sacrificing Isaac. He's about to sacrifice Isaac. And he's interrupted by who? Angel of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord calls to him from heaven. So he's not there. He's not standing right next to him. He's calling from heaven. And he says, "Don't do that. Don't do that. And the reason I don't want you to do that is because you didn't withhold your son from me." So the angel, again, shifts his speaking tone to be as if God is the speaker. Certainly the angel is not God. It's the angel of the Lord. but he can speak as with the first person authority of God here. Or rather, God is speaking through him with his first person authority. The angel of the Lord says Abraham didn't withhold Isaac from him. Genesis 22, 15 and 16, the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord." Again, we're continuing the same conversation between the same parties and this same first person definite article assertion of God through the angel. So this isn't to say that the angel itself is God, but when the angel appears and speaking on God's behalf, it's not as if, I guess, here's what I'd say. It's not like you or I have a message to read you, and then we start reading it. Instead, as this being begins to speak, it's as if God's voice is coming directly through it. The presence of God takes over, and the full authority is transmitted, not as a secondhand piece of information, like I said, like one person reading a message, but instead, God is talking directly through them. Then the angel states that he's revealing God's message. He confusingly ends by saying, "declares the Lord." Of course, God often refers to himself that way, so it's not completely an alien thing to do there. All right, let's move on to Hagar. Genesis 16:13. So she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. "You are a God of seeing," for she said, "truly I have seen him who looks after me." So of course, what's happened here with Hagar is she's fleeing the cruelty of Sarah, and an angel encounters her as she's fled. We see this in Genesis 16 and Genesis 21. Hagar's an Egyptian. She's a Gentile. She's a Gentile with God's first patriarch, right? But strangely enough, even in her great distress, she's running away from a situation she did not ask to be in. She was there to be Sarah's servant. But here's how I'm going to describe it. Through Abraham and Sarah's lack of faith and understanding, they try to force God's prophecy into reality themselves, right? What, man, that's a lot for someone to carry. Like, you're just there to be a servant, and suddenly you get dragged into this God prophecy, and for doing nothing but what you were told, this woman now hates you, and she wants to kill you. And so you're running for your life. That's the situation Hagar finds herself in here. But God comes to her and offers her comfort and reassurance that you're not going to be forgotten. Look, you didn't go through this for nothing. I see this as righteousness. And this is important because Hagar is the only woman in the Old Testament, the only woman that gets this sort of divine visit from God. This personal visit, "I'm here to talk to you about you. I'm concerned about it." Any other time that a woman encounters God, it's there for some other reason, like to announce, "Hey, you're going to have a child" or something. But God's here talking to this Gentile woman directly about the concern he has for her. And he sends an angel. And in dealing with the angel, Hagar recognizes that in fact is God. "You are a God of seeing. Truly I have seen him who looks after me." She recognized that in encountering the angel of the Lord and the message she is receiving, it's coming directly from God. The divine authority is not delegated. It's there. It's present. It's palpable. Let's take a look at Jacob. A lot going on with Jacob and angels. Genesis 28:12. "And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth. And the top of it reached to the heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it." So here we have, here we have Jacob sleeping on a rock at night, having this grand vision. The text says, in English it says ladder, but in Hebrew the word is not just like, well, that's definitely ladder. It could be a ladder, but also it could be a staircase. And I think that, again, if we look at the ancient context, what probably the vision was, was this idea of a ziggurat temple. So if you can imagine, surely you've seen like these ancient stone stepped pyramids, these sweeping staircases that go up to platforms, and then more sweeping staircases that go up, and the whole thing just looks like a giant step. That's a ziggurat. That's probably what they were building at the Tower of Babel. And the idea there is that I'm building this temple up to the heavens so my God can come down to visit me. And that's why they build it as steps. So in all likelihood, what he is envisioning is a great temple like that. And at the top of it is where God is enthroned, and these angels are going up and down, up and down. They're coming from his kingdom, and they're going back to his kingdom. And heaven and earth are being, they clearly are administratively connected. That's part of what God is trying to impart upon Jacob here is, hey, I'm in control of it all. Even when you're asleep here in the dirt, I'm still here with you. It doesn't take anything more than this. He gives him reassurance that his presence is continual, and he's always going to be involved so long as Jacob recognizes him as God. And then, of course, we get to Genesis 32, and we have a little bit of a wrestling episode. Genesis 32, 24. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. So Jacob's encounter is with a man. Again, another man. He doesn't see some mystical being. If he had, perhaps he wouldn't be so eager to get in hand-to-hand combat with it, right? If it was like shining or burning or looked like something he didn't recognize. But he sees a man. And in this encounter, of course, they're physically wrestling. We're not given it. I don't know what that was. We're not given an indicator that this is imagery or it's being imagined or it's a dream or a vision or a hallucination. This is real. And in fact, of course, we know that in the end, Jacob is injured as a result. Hosea 12:4 tells us he strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He met God at Bethel, and there God spoke with us. So the Bible clearly interprets this as not just a man and not just an angel. Jacob's having a direct encounter with God here. It's not ambiguous. And of course, as we go through this physical combat, we're told that Jacob prevailed against the man. And he prevails by using worldly means. Of course, Jacob is portrayed from the very beginning as someone who is ambitious to the point of willing to physically grapple for what he wants. He is holding his brother's heel as they exit the womb. So this whole thing isn't just coming out of nowhere, the wrestling and everything. And of course, as we go on and we learn that at the angel realizes that he's not going to be able to just defeat by wrestling. Well, why not? Why wouldn't God be able to win? Well, it's not that he isn't strong enough. That's not the point. The point is that Jacob is so invested in himself, and he believes so strongly that he is the agent of his own destiny here. He is powerful enough to make things happen. He tricked his father into getting his own blessing, right? His whole angle has always been, I'm not going to be the victim of circumstance here. And God's trying to let him know, no, it isn't you. Stop fighting. I'm not going to be able to just beat you up here and for you to get the message, so I'm going to have to do something else. I'm going to have to make sure that you understand that I have power beyond simply rolling around in the dirt. And so God touches his hip, ruining it, damaging it, injuring it to the point that this is now it's something that he limps the rest of his life. Well, why the hip? Why would that be important? Well, I think if you just ask a wrestler, you can get to that answer pretty quick. If anyone's had any experience with wrestling, they'll tell you the hip is the most important joint. You can wrestle another man with any other joint being compromised, but not the hip, because without your hip, you have no power. So God touches the hip and cancels his power. He can't fight. He nullifies his worldly ability right then and there. And Jacob knows that he is done. He realizes it. He has been deceived. He cannot win. He thought he was winning, but he's not. And he realizes that no amount of his effort is going to overcome God. And then, of course, he doesn't want to let go at the end. He's weeping. He's not holding on to him and continuing the struggle. He realizes he's defeated. He realizes this is God. And he doesn't want to let him go until he gets that blessing out of him. And so God gives him a blessing. He changes his name. Why does he change his name? He asks his name and he changes his name. Because again, remember, this all started with Jacob lying about who he was. And so God's got him in the spot. What is your name? I'm Jacob. I'm just Jacob. No, you're Israel. You're Israel. You've done the right thing. And so he receives that blessing. Again, it's not a man. It's not just an angel. He's having an authoritative divine encounter with God. Israel literally means he contends with God. And the God in that translation is the word El that we learned about in the Melchizedek lesson. All right, we're about to run out of time there. Any thoughts or questions before I wrap up with a prayer? Okay. Thank you all again. Let's go to our God in prayer. Father in heaven, we are blessed to call you Father. And we are so very thankful that we can gather together as a family and continue studying your word and learning about the lessons you taught our ancient ancestors and learning about the divine purposes that you always had in mind and the fulfillment that they all have in Jesus. And we offer our prayers in his name. Amen.